Welcome to Holistic's Tales from the Script. I'm Tom Moore. This is the first in our monthly series of Performance Prose podcasts celebrating the art and craft of writing and storytelling. Tales from the Script is a showcase of stories and interviews of writers and performers, and today I'm delighted to play host to Mari Campbell-Jack, who's come to us with a story all about murder. On the subject of murder, I think you should know that your statistical chances of being murdered are 1 in 20,000, but your chances of getting away with murder are about 1 in 2. Well, that's according to Google. Holistic does remind its listeners that murder is illegal. Now, without any further ado, I will pass the mic over to Mari Campbell-Jack so she can read us her story. Mari, if you please.
Be My Baby by Mari Campbell-Jack. I held it up to my face, felt the skin and filament hair against my cheek, plastered to the crown with fluid. The plates in the skull have not fused together, and underneath the thin skin you can see its heartbeat pulsing. It's called a fontanelle. I read about them on the internet. It's not far through to the brain. It's scrawny, all floppy and lolling like a half-stuffed toy. The joints are strange, kind of like when you open a pack of Link sausages. Not the posh ones you get in plastic trays, but the old-fashioned ones my granny always gets in a pack, squished together. Soon I'll introduce it to its daddy. He will love me for having it. He won't move now. Not now, it's here. I hadn't really been planning to get it for at least another month. They say that when you see an opportunity, you should take it. I tried it first time round about a year ago. It didn't work. I got nervous. I had planned it all for ages, through and through, again and again in my head. I practiced with a doll. I even dreamed about it towards the end. Do you know, at a certain point in development, if there isn't enough calcium in the diet, it leaches it from your bones, from its own mother's bones. I read that on the internet too. In the end, I froze. I couldn't do it. I told him it was gone, and he held me tight for ages, just stroked my hair lightly. It was like that for a time. Then I could feel him slipping away again. Something in the way he didn't really meet my eyes. I decided it was time again, time to be pregnant. It's funny how when you're pregnant, everyone stops to talk to you. Everyone is nice and smiles at you. I met her at a parade of shops at the end of the estate, where it turns into the Boswells and goes up market at Trinity. I'd seen her around, but never had a man with her, even at the weekends. Probably one of those women who doesn't know how to keep one. She had that simpering kind of femininity. We exchanged all the normal pleasantries. When are you due? Is it your first? Then she launches into this massive moan about cramps and the sleeplessness and the sickness, complained about not being able to move, being hungry all the time, people judging her for what she ate for fuck's sake. She even complained about strangers coming up and rubbing her belly. Lucky her, I thought. Lucky her. She had no idea what I've had to go through. No one did. I had to buy a belly over the internet. Yes, buy a belly, which I had to wear every day. It was hot and it got all sweaty underneath. I was tired of hearing her go on about herself in her bowed and fucking dress like she was some kind of special case. I turned around and told her, I've had all those problems too, but I don't resent my child. That shut her up. When I saw her coming towards me on the water of Leith, I knew. It was like the universe was just telling me, go on, this is your chance. This, I know, is my purpose. She waddled along the path, wearing some great green hoodie and a pair of leggings. She looked like a fucking foil-wrapped Easter egg. When she saw me, her eyes narrowed. I knew she didn't like me. Why should she? I don't like her. She didn't deserve to have a baby more than I did. And they say everything happens for a reason, so I thought I might as well take my chance. The coast was clear, and when I'd seen her coming, I'd managed to get the hammer up a sleeve so it didn't look obvious. I stepped as close as I could, let it drop into my hand, and swung, hitting her clean on the right side of the head. It made a peculiar kind of noise, kind of crunchy, but still dull. She crumpled. I guess she wouldn't have expected me to be able to move as quickly as I did. That's the thing with these fake bellies. They're awfully realistic. I don't know what I'd do without the internet. It was hard to drag her over the side of the bank. God, that pregnant bitch was heavy, and the ground was still damp from the rain the night before. I was panting and scratched from the bramble jags that caught me while hefting and heaving to get her there. I could smell the earth. It still retained the last of its warmth mixed with rain. It gave off the scent of nature, dog shit and mud, squashed bitter brambles, all decorated with the foil of crisp packets and the aluminium of cans. This is it, I thought, while trying to catch my breath. This is nature. Not some nice council-pruned garden, but this, here, hidden behind an old embankment from an old piece of railway that the council doesn't give an arse if it don't have fireworks end of the city. I took out the scalpel, ready to cut, first through her clothes, then through her. The first cut was vertical. I wanted to press down hard with the scalpel, but I was surprised at how easy it was. I was through the outer layer of skin like that. Blood immediately appeared and started to cover my hands, more blood than I expected. It was thick. Of course, on YouTube, they have clamps to hold the flaps of skin back and suction thingies too. Oh, nurses as well, to mop your brow. No such luxury for me. I carried on cutting through the flesh, the fat, the sticky sinew. It smells the inside of the human body of rust and metal. And it smells warm. She opened up easily for me. I stood over the stomach, panting, breathless, sweat dripping off me and my hair water falling over my face, through the blood now steadily trickling down both sides of her still-stretched belly like lava down a volcano and soaking through all her clothes. I could see it, nestling there, waiting for me, inside the womb. I'd like to say it was like a precious jewel or some of the other sentimental stuff trotted out whenever a baby is around. It wasn't. It looked like an alien, all curled up and deformed, floating with a head too big for the rest of it. I pulled it out, lifted it up from the warm slosh of clear amniotic fluid. Out it came. Wet and sticky and purple, and out it came and it started to cry, a shrill cry, almost with a squeak as the vocal cords tried to adjust to the dryness of air. When I heard that cry, I knew it was a success. It was mine. I had achieved. I cut the umbilical cord and packed the equipment away, then walked back onto the path. That was it. Now I'm on a bus going home and holding it, feeling its tiny lungs still struggling for breath, and it's mine. They do say what's for you won't go by you. Won't Daddy be pleased to see it? Won't Daddy love me now?
That was your story. Would you like to tell us a little bit about what inspired you to write it?
Well, it was actually an article on the BBC News website about a woman in America who had done exactly that, killed a pregnant woman, then C-sectioned her and stole the baby. And I think I was just so horrified. I was just like,
What on earth would make somebody do something like that? It's just totally irrational. And I kind of just researched a bit online and found out, and there's been 10 of these killings in America in the past 10 years. Wow. Thankfully, none in Britain at all. And these are women who have kind of been interviewed extensively by psychologists. And I think I was just fascinated by how twisted the human mind can become.
Yeah, I'm genuinely shocked to hear that it's quite so common.
Well, 10 in 10 years, I suppose, compared to some other violent crime, isn't that common. But, you know, once is too often with something like that, really.
Moving on to your development as a writer, can you tell us what the first thing you can remember writing is?
Yeah, as far as I can remember, I've always written. But the first clear memory I have is I made two books when I was in primary school, both stories about a family of dust bowls that lived under my bed, and I illustrated them myself as well.
Do you know if you still have them lying around?
No,
somewhere?
I think they've been thrown out now.
Are there any stories that have particularly influenced your development as a writer? When you...
I think at the moment, I'd say I'm actually influenced a lot by sort of my contemporaries in Edinburgh and going to things like Alyssa Ink, Writer's Block, Inky Fingers, and hearing what people are doing now is kind of what's my biggest influence. But I'd say when I was growing up, one of the stories, which I know we talked about a bit earlier, was A Telltale Heart by Edgar Allan Poe, which I suppose in a way does have some parallels with the one I've just read, because again, it's about a mind which has sort of become twisted and isn't at all within reality.
You've performed quite a lot as a poet. Mm-hmm. You've done it with Inky Fingers. You were at Happy Verse Day, our joint event that we had. What do you think the contrasts and crossovers between performance poetry and performance prose are?
Well, I wouldn't really class myself as a performance poet. I'm a page poet who performs. There's the poetry world's very small, but we still like to split ourselves up into tiny little warring factions. And it's something that it's actually quite difficult to describe, but you know it when you see it. So I would say that I perform page poetry, but I did used to do performance poetry with, I don't know if you were around Edinburgh this long ago, but there was a night called Big Word, which ran for a long time. So I used to do performance poetry with them. I was down at the Glastonbury Festival with some people from there as well. I think anything you do in writing feeds into all the writing you do.
Yeah.
And I think the sort of training I got with Big Word and doing the performance poetry helped me perform my prose. And I think it also helps me just be a bit calmer, because the more you do something, the calmer you can be.
You are the proud mother of a young girl, 4 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Has your approach to writing changed with motherhood at all?
Well, I think you don't have as much time, so you kind of have to be a bit more thoughtful about how you're spending your time and sort of going, well, what do I want to do this week? So sometimes I'll write poetry while I'm cooking in the kitchen. So sometimes you're squeezing things in a lot more. I think in terms of what I actually write, I'd say, for me anyway, parenthood has given me a more breadth and more depth emotionally in my life. And there's sort of a lot more ups and downs emotionally with it as well. And I think anything that happens in your life ends up informing your writing.
Now, you're fairly politically active. You do some political blogging and that sort of thing. Do you think that writers have a responsibility to be politically conscious?
Well, as you say, I am, I'd say, politically conscious. I work in politics. I've been working in monitoring the Scottish Parliament for about 8 or 9 years, and I've done voluntary work with political parties, and I blog politically. So I'd say if I write something that is politically conscious, it's because it's me who's writing, and that's part of my personality. I think as soon as you start telling people you should do this, you should do that, you're putting limits on them, and I think a good writer is somebody who's free to be themselves. And I also think there's absolutely nothing wrong in writing for entertainment.
Yeah. Now, not that long ago, I think you finished now. Not that long ago, you were sharing your first pamphlet of poetry online.
Yes, I was tweeting that on Twitter.
Could you talk a bit about how you think social media has affected how people are writing?
Well, I think it affects people because you're more able to speak to your audience and connect with them. And I think also in a country like Scotland, it's really good because we're so big and so rural, and there's so much gaps for, if you're at the Central Belt, there's so many gaps in between where people live. It's a great way that you can network with other writers and meet other writers and feed off ideas. So I think, for me anyway, and some people might feel this is a bit overblown, I think social media is going to be one of those things that can really push Scotland as a creative nation in the way that having the printing press was able to push people to be more creative or just get more information out there.
Oh, and this is a great question that I just love asking everybody. Do you think there's one essential trait that all writers need?
Curiosity.
No. Do you want to elaborate on that, or do you just like the one-word answer?
I just think if you're bored with the world, then your writing's going to be very boring.
I think you're right. I think seeking out new things is a very important trait. We were talking a little bit about this earlier, but you and I have something in common, in that we're both dyslexic. Do you think your dyslexia has influenced in your writing at all?
It's sometimes a bit hard to answer questions when people ask me about dyslexia because I've never not been dyslexic, so I don't have a comparison. When I compare myself to non-dyslexic people, I do think I think in different ways and I make connections in different ways, and I think that helps me creatively.
Yeah.
It doesn't help me with my grammar and my spelling, unfortunately, which I still have to get friends to read through. But I think my ideas are strong and very often unusual for people who don't think the same way I do.
Would you like to tell us about anything you're working on at the moment?
I am working on what's going to be my last poetry project for a while. At the end of the year, I'll be starting the Creative Writing Masters at Napier. It doesn't have a poetry element, so for those 2 years, I'll probably be abandoning my poetry writing. So I've got one last hurrah, which I have an exhibition which is going to be at Central Library in Edinburgh in December and January. I'm writing a series of poems about another world. There's a kind of fantasy sort of element in there, and they're being illustrated by a very talented artist called Caroline List.
Brilliant. We can all go check that out. While at Ellistink's Time Will Tell, an event based around time which I hosted, we asked you what year in history you'd like to live. And you said you'd like to live in 2012, because it's when lots of good things are going to happen, and the future. Now, I was wondering, now it is 2012, whether or not your opinion has changed at all?
Well, we're not quite halfway through the year. It's been okay. There's been some downs, but there's been a lot of ups. I've had some really good readings I've enjoyed. I got promoted at work. I've made some new friends. I'm learning to swim as well. So there's been some really good things that have happened so far this year. But we've still got quite a lot of the year to go. So I'll maybe check back in come December.
Now, in keeping with our murder theme, I was wondering if I could ask you what your favourite murder story is.
Well, it'd probably be the one that I mentioned before, Telltale Heart. I do like a good bit of crime fiction, but unfortunately, I think it's very hard to write crime fiction really well and avoid all the stereotypes at the same time. But I think Poe, he set the bar, really, with that one for me, I'd say.
All right, then. Well, thank you very much. That's all from us at Listening this time. Many thanks to our guest writer, Marie Campbell-Jack, and thanks to you for listening. If you want to learn more about us or our readers, be sure to check out our website at illicitink.net. I've been Tom Moore, and I hope very much to speak at you again. Bye-bye.